I am Houston Smith, Professor of Philosophy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and I invite you to a conversation arranged by the Blaisdell Institute of Claremont, California, with Krishnamurti, who was raised by Annie Besant and the Theosophists to be a world teacher, and who, though he discarded the mantle of Theosophy, did indeed become a sage of our century. One whose voice is heard as much by the youth of today as throughout the world for the last 60 years. Krishnamurti, it may be that this morning I will have only one question, which in one way or another I'll be coming back to in various ways. In your writings, in your speaking, time and again you come back to this wonderful little word, lucid, and lucidity. But is it possible, living as we are in this confused and confusing world, torn by conflicting voices without and conflicting passions within, with hearts that seem star-crossed and tensions that never go, is it possible in such a life, in such a world, to live with total lucidity? And if so,
I wonder, sir, what you mean by that word, lucid. I wonder whether you mean clarity.
That's what first comes to mind,
yeah.
Yes.
Is this clarity a matter of intellectual perception, or is it a perception with your whole being, not merely a fragment of your being, but with the totality of one's own being?
Certainly has the ring of the latter. It's the latter.
So it is not fragmentary. Therefore, it's not intellectual or emotional or sentimental. And so, is it possible in this confused world with so many contradictions and such misery and starvation, not only outwardly but also inwardly, such insufficiency psychologically, outwardly, there are so many rich societies. Is it at all possible for a human being living in this world to find within himself a clarity that is constant, that is true in the sense, not contradictory? Is it possible for a human being to find it?
That's my question.
Your question. I don't see why not. I don't see why it shouldn't be found by anybody who is really quite serious. Most of us are not serious at all. We want to be entertained. We want to be told what to do. We want someone else to tell us how to live, what this clarity is, what is truth, what is God, what is righteous behavior, and so on. Now, if one could discard completely all the authority of psychological specialists, as well as the specialists in religion, if one could really deeply negate all authority of that kind, then one would be relying totally on oneself.
Well, now I feel like maybe right off I'm contradicting what you're suggesting, because my impulse after you've said that it seems to you that it is possible to achieve this lucidity, my impulse is to ask you immediately, how?
Wait, sir.
But you say, am I looking to authority?
No.
That?
What is necessary is the freedom from authority, not the how. The how implies a method, a system, a way trodden by others, and someone to tell you, do this and you will find.
Now, are you saying with this that it's an inappropriate question to ask you how this lucidity is to be achieved?
No, not at all, sir. But the how implies that. The how implies a method.
And
a system. And the moment you have a system and a method, you become mechanical. You just do what you're told. And that's not clarity. It's like a child being told by its mother what it should do from morning till night. And therefore it becomes dependent on the mother or the father, whatever it be, and there is no clarity. So, to have clarity, the first essential thing is freedom. Freedom from authority.
And I feel in a kind of bind because this freedom is attractive too, and I want to go towards that. But I also want to pick your mind and ask you how to proceed. Am I moving away from my freedom if I ask you how to proceed?
No, sir. But I'm pointing out the difficulty of that word, the implication of that word. The how.
Yes.
Not the one is wandering away from freedom or any other thing of that kind, but the word how implies intrinsically a mind that says, please tell me what to do.
And I ask again, is that a mistaken question? Is that a wrong question?
I should think that's a wrong question, the how. But rather if you said, what are the things, the obstructions that prevent clarity, then we can go into it. But if you say right from the beginning, please, what is the method? There have been dozen methods. And they've all failed. They have not produced clarity or enlightenment or a state of peace in man. On the contrary, these methods have divided man. You have your method and somebody else has his method, and these methods are everlastingly quarreling with each other.
Are you saying that once you abstract certain principles and formulate them into a method, this becomes too crude?
That's right.
The intricacies,
the intricacies and the complexities and the living quality of clarity.
So that the how must always be immediate from where one stands, the particular individual.
I would never put the how at all. The how should never enter into the mind.
Well, this is a hard teaching. It may be true, and I'm reaching for it, and yet I don't know that it's possible. I don't feel that it's possible completely to relinquish the question how in every sense.
Sir, I think we'll be able to understand each other if we could go a little slowly, not into the how, but what are the things that prevent clarity?
All right, fine.
Through negation, come to clarity, not through the positive method of following a system.
Fine. All right. This is the via negativa.
Via negativa.
Approach through the back door. That's good.
That's the only way.
All right.
The positive way of the how has led man to divide himself, his loyalties, his pursuits. You have the how of yours and the how of somebody else and the method of this and that, and they're all lost.
Fine.
So right. If we could put aside that question, the how, for the time being,
right.
And probably you'll never put it afterwards, right. And I hope you won't.
Well,
so, what is important is to find out what are the obstructions, the hindrances, the blocks that prevent clear perception of human anxiety, fear, sorrow, and the ache of loneliness, the utter lack of love and all that.
Good. Let's explore the virtues of
that's
negative. What are these obstacles?
Now, first of all, I feel there must be freedom. Freedom from authority.
Could we stop right there on this matter of authority? When you say we should renounce all authority, it seems to me that the goal of total freedom and self-reliance is a valid one, and yet along the way it seems to me that we rely and should rely on all kinds of authorities in certain spheres. When I go to a new territory and I stop to ask the filling station attendant which way to go, I accept his authority as knowing more about that than I do. And isn't this the way...
Obviously, sir. Obviously, the specialist knows little more than the layman.
Right.
The experts, either in surgery or in technological knowledge, they are obviously, they know much more than any other person,
right,
who is not concerned with that particular technique. But we are considering not authority along any particular line, but the whole problem of authority.
And in that area is the answer to understand the areas in which there is specialized authority, which we should accept.
We should accept. And where authority is detrimental.
Yes.
Authority is destructive.
Right.
So there are two problems involved in this question of authority. There is not only the authority of the expert, let's call him for the moment,
right,
which is necessary, but also the authority of the man who says, psychologically, I know, you don't.
I see. So
this is true, this is false. You must do this and you must not.
So one should never turn over one's life to...
to anybody.
Anyone else.
Because the churches throughout the world, very different religions, have said, give your life to us. We will direct it. We'll shape it. We'll tell you what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Do this, follow the Savior, follow the church, and you will have peace.
Mm-hmm.
But on the contrary, churches have produced terrible wars. Religions of every kind have brought about fragmentation of the mind. So the question is not freedom from a particular authority, but the whole conceptual acceptance of authority.
Yes. All right, I think I see that, and that one should never abdicate one's own conscience.
No, I'm not talking of conscience. Our conscience is such a petty little affair.
Well, maybe we're thinking about conscience, and I'm thinking about the conscience of how I should live my life.
We have started out to say, asking the question, why is it man, who has lived for 2 million years and more, why is man not capable of clear perception and action?
Yeah.
That is the question involved.
Right. And your first point is that it's because he doesn't accept the full responsibility.
I don't say that. No, I haven't come to that point yet. I'm saying that there, as we said, we must approach this problem negatively.
Mm-hmm.
which means that I must find out what are the blockages,
the obstacles, yes.
obstacles right. which prevent clear perception.
Right.
Now, one of the major blocks or hindrances is this total acceptance of authority.
All right, fine. So be ye lamps unto yourself.
That's right. This is what so you must be a light to yourself.
Very good. All
and right. to be a light to yourself, you must deny every other light, which, however great that light be. Whether it be the life of the light of the Buddha or XYZ.
Yeah, perhaps accepted here or there, but nevertheless you retain the say-so as to where
insight
might be valid. And
no, sir,
never accept
my own authority. What authority have I? My authority is the authority of the society. I am conditioned to accept authority. When I reject the authority of the outer, I accept the authority of the inner. And my authority of the inner is the result of the conditioning in which I have been brought up.
All right, I thought I had this in place, and I guess perhaps I still do. The only point that I'm not quite sure about at this point is, it seems to me, while assuming, accepting, affirming, and maintaining one's own freedom...
How can a prisoner accept ideologically or theoretically, except he is free? He is in prison. And that is the fact from which we must move. Accept a vague, fantastic, ideological freedom, which doesn't exist. What exists is that man has bound to this total authority.
All right, and this is the first thing that we must see and must remove or rise
completely
above.
That must go for a man who is serious, who wants to find out the truth or see things very clearly.
All right, fine. Now another?
That is one of the major points. And the demand of freedom. Not only from authority, but the demand from fear,
right,
which makes him accept authority.
Right. That seems true also. And so beneath the craving for authority
is
fear, which we look to authority
That's right.
to free.
And so the fear makes man violent. Not only territorial violence, but sexual violence and different forms of violence.
Yeah. All right.
So, authority, the freedom from authority implies the freedom from fear.
All right.
And the freedom from fear implies the cessation of every form of violence.
If we stop violence, then our fear recedes.
No, sir. It's not a question of recession, of fear. Let's put it around the other way, sir. Man is violent. Linguistically, psychologically, in daily life, he is violent. Which ultimately leads to war.
There's a lot of it around.
And man has accepted war as the way of life. Whether in the office, whether at home, or in the playing field, or anywhere, war is accepted as the way of life, which is the very essence of violence.
Yes.
Now, and aggression are all that's involved. So, as long as man accepts violence, lives a way of life which is violent, he perpetuates fear, and therefore violence, and also accepts authority.
So these three are a kind of
vicious circle,
each playing into the other.
The churches say, live peaceful, be kind, and love your neighbor, which is all sheer nonsense. They don't mean it. the merely verbal assertion that has no meaning at all. It's just an idea. Because the morality of society, which is the morality of the church, is immoral.
As we try to see then these things that stand between us and lucidity and freedom, we find the authority and fear and violence working together to obstruct us. Where do we go from there?
It's not going to some place, but it's understanding this fact that most of us live a life in this ambiance, in this cage of authority, fear and violence. We can't go beyond it unless one is free from it. Not intellectually or theoretically, but actually be free from every form of authority. Not the authority of the expert, but the feeling of dependence on authority.
All right. I think
that. Then, is it possible for a human being to be free completely of fear? Not only at the superficial level of one's consciousness, but also at the deeper level, what's called the unconscious.
Is it possible?
Otherwise, you are bound to accept authority of anybody. Any Tom, Dick and Harry with a little bit of knowledge, a little bit of cunning explanation or intellectual formulas, you're bound to fall for him. But the question whether a human being, so heavily conditioned as he is, through propaganda of the church, through propaganda of society, morality and all the rest of it, whether such a human being can really be free from fear. That is the basic question, sir.
That's what I wait to hear. And
now,
can he?
I say it is possible. Not in abstraction, but actually it is possible.
All right, and my impulse again is to say how.
And the refrain, sorry, you see, when you say how, you stop to learn.
All right.
You cease to learn.
All right, let's just forget that I said that, because I don't want to get distracted.
No, you can never even ask that, ever, because we are learning. Learning about the nature and the structure of human fear. At the deepest level and also at the most superficial level. And we're learning about it. And when you're learning, you can't ask suddenly, how am I to learn? There is no how. If you're interested, if the problem is vital, intense, it has to be solved to live peacefully. There is no how. You say, let's learn about it.
All right.
So the moment you bring in the how, you move away from the central fact of learning.
All right, that's fine. Let's continue on the shaft of learning about this.
So, what does it mean to learn?
Are you asking me?
Yes, obviously. What does it mean to learn?
It means to perceive how one should proceed in a given domain.
No, sir. Surely. Here is a problem of fear. I want to learn about it. First of all, I mustn't condemn it. I mustn't say it's terrible and run away from it.
Sounds to me like you've been condemning it one way or another.
I don't. I want to learn. When I want to learn about something, I look. There's no condemnation at all.
Well, we were going at this through a negative route.
Which is what I'm doing.
And fear is an obstacle.
About which I'm going to learn.
All right.
Therefore, I can't condemn it.
Well, it's not good. You're not advocating it.
No, I'm neither advocating or not. Here is a fact of fear. I want to learn about it. Mm-hmm. Moment I learn about something, I'm free of it. So learning matters.
Yes.
What is the what is implied in learning? What is implied in learning? First of all, to learn about something, there must be complete cessation of condemnation or justification.
All right. Yes, I can see that. If we're going to understand something, if we keep our emotions out of it and just try to dispassionately...
To learn. It's, you're introducing words like dispassion. Huh? That's unnecessary. If I want to learn about that camera, I begin to look at it, undo it, go into it. There's not a question of dispassion or passion. I want to learn. So I want to learn about this question of fear.
Okay.
So to learn, there must be no condemnation, no justification of fear, and therefore no escape verbally from the fact of fear.
Right.
But the tendency is to deny it.
To deny the reality of
fear? The reality of fear. The reality that fear is causing all these things. To deny by saying, I must develop courage. So, please, we are going into this problem of fear because it's really a very important question. Mm-hmm. Whether human mind can ever be free of fear.
It certainly is.
Which means whether the mind is capable of looking at fear, looking,
mm-hmm.
not in abstraction, but actually at fear as it occurs.
Facing fear.
Facing fear.
Right. All right.
No.
We should do this, and I agree with you.
No,
we can't
to look,
deny
to
it.
Face it, no condemnation.
All right.
No justification.
Simply being
aware,
truly objective.
Aware of fear.
Acknowledging.
I don't acknowledge it. There is the camera there. I don't acknowledge it. It is there.
All right. I don't want to distract our line
that's
of
why,
thought
please,
with these words.
That's why one has to be awfully careful of words, because the word is not the thing, therefore I don't want to move away from this. So, to learn about fear, there must be no condemnation or justification.
All right.
That's fact. Then, the mind can look at fear. What is fear? There are every kind of fear. Fear of darkness, fear of the wife, fear of the husband, fear of war, fear of storm, fear of... so many psychological fears.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot possibly have the time to analyze all the fears. That would take the whole lifetime. By then you have not even understood any fear.
Right. So it's the phenomenon of fear itself rather
that
than any specific...
Any particular fear.
Right. Mm? Now what should we learn?
Wait, I'm going to show you something. Go slow. Now, to learn about something, you must be in complete contact with it. I want to look, sir. I want to learn about fear. Therefore, I must look at it. I must face it.
Yes.
Now, to face something implies a mind that does not want to solve the problem of fear.
To look at fear
is not to solve the problem of fear.
Now,
this is very important to understand. Because then, if I want to solve fear, I'm more concerned with the solution of fear than facing fear.
A moment ago, though, we were saying we should face
it. I am facing it. But if I say I must solve it, I am beyond it already. I'm not looking.
You say that if we're trying to solve the problem of fear, then we're not truly facing it. Is that right?
Quite right, sir. You see, to face fear, mind must be completely, must give its complete attention to fear. And if you give partial attention, which is say, I want to solve it and go beyond it, you're not giving complete attention.
I can see that if you have a split attention, you're not split fully attentive.
So, in giving complete attention to the learning about fear, there are several problems involved in it. I must be brief because our time is limited. Mm-hmm. We generally consider fear as something outside us. So there is this question of the observer and the observed. The observer says, I am afraid, and he puts fear something away from me.
I'm not sure that that's true. When I feel afraid, I am afraid. I feel it very much in here.
Yes, in here. But when you when you observe it, it is different.
When I observe fear, then I tend to put it out.
Put it outside.
Well, again, that doesn't seem quite right, because it certainly at
the moment of fear, there is neither the observer nor
that's
the observed.
True. That is very true.
That's what I'm saying. At the crisis, at the moment of actual fear, there is neither the observer. There is no observer.
It fills the horizon.
The moment you begin to look at it, face it, there is this division.
Between the fearful self and the
non-fearful self.
The bear who's going to eat me out there.
So there it is. Right. So in trying to learn about fear, there is this division between the observer and the observed. Mm-hmm. Now, is it possible to look at fear without the observer? Please, sir, this is really quite intricate question and complex question. One has to go into very deeply. As long as there is the observer who is going to learn about the fear, there is a division.
That's true. We're not in full contact with it. That's true.
Therefore, in that division is the conflict of trying to get rid of fear, justify fear. So, is it possible to look at fear without the observer? So that you are completely in contact with it all the time.
Well, then you're experiencing fear.
I wouldn't like to use that word experience, because experience implies going through something, finishing with it.
All right. I don't know what word you... It seems better than looking at, because looking at does seem
therefore
to imply a distinction between an observer and observed.
We are using that word, observing. Being aware of fear without choice. Which means the choice implies the observer, choosing whether I don't like this, I like this. Therefore, the observer... when the observer is absent, there is choiceless awareness of fear.
All right.
Then what takes place? That's the whole question.
All right.
The observer creates the linguistic difference between himself and the thing observed. Language comes in there. Therefore, the word prevents being completely in contact with fear.
Yes.
Yeah.
Words can be a screen.
Yes. That's all what we are saying.
All right.
So the word mustn't interfere.
True. All right. We have to get beyond that.
Beyond the word. But is that possible to be beyond the word? Theoretically we say yes, but we are slave to words.
Far too much so, yes.
I mean, it's obvious. We are slave to words.
All right.
So the mind has to become aware of its own slavery to word, realizing that the word is never the thing.
Right.
So the mind is free of the word to look. That's all implied. So look, I want to understand, I mean, the relationship between two people, husband and wife, is the relationship between of images. Obviously. I mean, there's no dispute about it. You have your image and she has her image about you. The relationship is between these two images. Now, the real relationship, human relationship, is when the images don't exist. In the same way, the relationship between the observer and the observed ceases when the world is not.
Yes, that remains.
So he is directly in contact with fear.
Right. We pass through the screen.
There it is. There is fear.
Yes.
Now, there is fear at the conscious level, which is fairly, one can understand fairly quickly. But there are the deeper layers of fear, so-called at the hidden parts of the mind, to be aware of that. Now, that means, is it possible to be aware without analysis? Analysis takes time.
Right. Surely it's possible.
How? Not the how of method. You said surely it's possible. Is it? There is this whole reservoir of fear. Of the fear of the race, fear of the whole content of the unconscious. The content is the unconscious.
All right.
Now, to be aware of all that, which means not through dreams. Again, that takes too long.
Now you're talking about whether we can be explicitly aware of the full reach of mind.
Yes, full content reach of the mind, which is both the conscious as well as the deeper layers. The totality of consciousness.
Yes, and can we be explicitly aware of all of that?
Of all of that.
I'm not sure.
I say it is possible. It is only possible when you are aware during the day what you say, the words you use, the gestures, the way you talk, the way you walk, what your thoughts are. To be completely and totally aware of all that.
Do you think all of that can be before you in total awareness?
Absolutely. When there is no condemnation and justification. When you are directly in contact with it.
It seems to me that the mind is sort of like an iceberg with regions of it.
An iceberg is 9/10 below and 1/10 above. It is possible to see the whole of it. During the day, if you are aware of your thoughts, of your feelings, if you are aware of the motives, all which demands a mind that's highly sensitive.
Well, we can certainly be aware of much, much more than we usually are. But when you say we can be aware of all the psychological factors...
I'm showing you. You're denying it. You say it's not possible. Then it's not possible.
No, I'd like to believe that.
I know. It's not a question of belief. I don't have to believe in what I see. It's only when I don't see I believe in God, this or that.
For me, it's a matter of belief. Maybe not for you.
No, belief is the most destructive part of life. Why should I believe the sunrise? I see it sunrise. I believe, so when I do not know what love is, then I believe in love.
Like so many times in when I listen to you speak, it seems to me like a half-truth which is stated as a full truth, and I wonder whether that's for the sake of emphasis,
well, sir,
or whether it really is.
It
you really
mean to, me
to carry it all the way.
To me it really is.
We've been speaking of the elements that block us, the things that block us from a life of lucidity and freedom. Authority, violence, fear. Our time is short, and I wouldn't like to spend all the time on these obstacles. Is there anything affirmative we can say about this condition?
So anything affirmative indicates authority. It's only the authoritarian mind that says, let's be affirmed.
Now,
which is in opposition to negation. But the negation we are talking about has no opposite.
Well now, when I ask you for an affirmative statement, it doesn't seem to me that I'm turning over a decision to you as an authority.
No.
I just want to hear if you have something interesting to say, which I will then stand judgment upon.
With regard to what, sir? With regard to what?
As to whether it speaks to my condition.
What? With regard to what? You said something. About what?
Yes, about the state of life that it seems to me we're groping for in our words to describe.
Now, are you trying to say, sir, that life is only in the present?
In one sense, I think that's true.
Right.
Is that what
are you
you're
trying
saying?
To? No, I'm asking you. Is this what you're asking? Is life to be divided into the past, present, and future, which becomes fragmentary, and not a total perception of living?
Well, again, as so often, it seems to me that the answer is both and. In one sense, it is a unity, and it is present, and the present is all we have. But man is a time-binding animal, as they say.
Is time by
before his, and
yes,
after.
So man is the result of time.
Yes.
Not only evolutionary, but chronological as well as psychological.
Yes.
So, he is the result of time. The past, present, and future.
Right.
Now, he lives mostly in the past.
All right, mostly.
He is the past.
All right. Again, it's
No. I'll show it to you. He is the past. Because he lives in memory.
Not totally.
No, wait, so follow it step by step. He lives in the past, and therefore he thinks and examines and looks from the background of the past.
Yes. Which is both good and...
We're not saying good and bad.
Right.
There's no good, bad, and bad past. We are concerned with the past.
Yes.
Don't give it a name.
All right.
By calling it good or bad, then we're lost.
All right.
He lives in the past, examines everything from the past, and projects the future from the past.
Yes.
So, he lives in the past. He is the past. And when he thinks of the future or the present, he thinks in terms of the past.
All right. You see, it seems to me that most of the time that is true, but there are new perceptions, there are breakthroughs, new experiences that break through the
new
momentum of the past.
New experiences break through only when there is an absence of the past.
Well, it seems to me like it's a merging of things that we perforce bring with us from the past, but bring to play upon the novel
of the novelty, sir, the newness, sir, of the present, and it's a fusion, sir, of those two.
Look, sir, if I want to understand something new, I must look at it with clear eyes.
Yes.
I can't bring the past with all the recognition process, with all the memories, and then translate what I see as new. Surely, sir, just a minute. The man who invented the jet must have forgotten or be completely familiar with the propeller, piston.
Right.
And then there was an absence of knowledge in which he discovered the new.
That's fine.
Wait, no, not a question, that's fine. It is, that's the only way to operate in life.
Yes.
That is, I must be completely aware, there must be complete awareness of the past.
Yes.
And absence of the past to see the new.
All right.
Or to come upon the new.
All right.
Not, you're conceding reluctantly, that's not...
I'm conceding reluctantly because I think I see what you're saying, and I think I agree with the point that you're making, but it's also true that... one operates in terms
of the past.
Symbols that
one
has, and you can't, it's not as though we begin de novo.
No, de novo is not
rasa.
But we have to begin de novo because the life demands it, because we have lived in this way, accepting war, hatred, brutality, competition, and anxiety, guilt, all that is the, we have accepted that. We live that way. And I am saying, to bring about a different quality, a different way of living, the past must disappear.
We must be open to the new.
Therefore,
absolutely,
the past must have no meaning.
That I can't go along with.
That is what the whole world is objecting. The established order says, I can't let go for the new to be. And the young people, or throughout the world, say, let's revolt against the old. But they don't understand the whole complications of it. Because they say, but what have you given us? Except examinations, job, and the repetition of the old pattern. War and favorite wars, wars.
Well, you're pointing out, it seems to me, the importance of not being slaves to the past. And that's so true, and I don't want to in any way...
Past being the tradition, past being the pattern of morality,
yes,
which is the social morality, which is not moral.
But at the same time, there's only one generation, namely ourselves, that separates the future generation from the caveman. And
yes,
what...
I agree.
If were to be totally rescinded, then we would start right back.
No. To break through the past demands a great deal of intelligence, a great deal of sensitivity to the past.
Yeah.
You can't just break away from it.
Okay, I'm content. That's fine.
Right. So, the problem really, sir, is, can we live a different way?
Hear, hear. Right.
A different way in which there are no wars, no hatreds, in which man loves man without competition, without division. We say, you are a Christian, you are a Catholic, you are a Protestant, you are this. That's also immature. There's no meaning. It's an intellectual, sophisticated division. And that's not a religious mind at all. That's not religion. A religious mind is a mind that has no hatred, that lives completely without fear, without anxiety, in which there is not a particle of antagonism. Therefore, that a mind that loves, that's the different dimension of living altogether. And nobody wants that.
And in another sense, everybody wants that.
But they won't go after it.
They won't go after
you? No, of course not. They're distracted by so many other things. They're so heavily conditioned by their past, they hold on to it.
Well, I think there's some who will go after
you. These are very few.
The numbers doesn't
matter. Minority,
how many?
Sir, the minority is always the most important thing.
Krishnamurti, as I listen to you and try to listen through the words to what you're saying, it seems to me that what I hear is first that I should work out, and each of us should work out his own salvation, not leaning on authorities outside. Second, not to allow words to form a film between us and actual experience, not to mistake the menu for the meal. And third, not to let the past swallow up the present, take possession through responding to it through conditionings from the past, but rather to be always open to the new, the novel, the fresh. And finally, it seems to me you're saying something like the key to doing this is a radical reversal in our point of view. It's as though we were prisoners straining at the bars for the light and looking for the glimpse of light we see out there and wondering how we could get out towards it, while actually the door of the cell is open behind us. If only we would turn around, we could walk out into freedom. This is what it sounds to me like you're saying. Is this
a little bit, sir? A little bit.
All right. What else? What other than that? Or if you want to amplify.
So, surely, sir, in this is involved the everlasting struggle, conflict, man caught in his own conditioning,
yes,
and straining, struggling, beating his head to be free.
Yes.
So, and again, we have accepted, with the help of religions and all the rest of the group, that effort is necessary. That's part of life. That is the highest form of blindness, of limiting man to say you must everlastingly live in effort.
And you think we don't have to?
Not I think. It is. So it's not a question of thought. Thought is the most.
Right. Let's delete those two words and just say we don't have to.
But to live without effort requires the greatest sensitivity and the highest form of intelligence. You don't just say, well, I won't struggle and become like a cow.
Right, right.
But one has to understand the how conflict arises, the duality in us.
Yes.
The fact of what is and what should be. There is the conflict. If there is no what should be, which is ideological, which is non-real, which is fictional, and see what is, and face it, live with it, without the what is, what should be, then there is no conflict at all. It's only when you compare, evaluate with what should be, and then look with what should be, with the what is, then conflict arises.
There should be no tension between the ideal and the actual.
No ideal at all. Why should we have an ideal? The ideal is the most idiotic form of conceptual thinking. Why should I have an ideal? When the fact is burning there, why should I have an ideal about anything?
Well, now, once more, when you speak like that, it seems to me you break it into an either-or.
No, no,
not the ideal, but the actual, whereas it seems to me the truth is somehow both of these must
No, truth is not a mixture of the ideal and the what is. Then you produce some melange of some dirt. There is only what is. But, sir, look, take a very simple example. We human beings are violent. Why should I have an ideal of non-violence? Why can't I deal with the fact?
Of violence?
Of violence, without non-violence. The ideal is an abstraction, is a distraction. The fact is I'm violent, man is violent. Let's tackle that. Let's come to grips with that and see if we can't live without violence.
Yes, but then...
there is no dualistic process in this. There is only the fact that I'm violent. Man is violent. And is it possible to be free of that? Why should I introduce the idealistic nonsense into it?
You're no dualism, you say, no separation. And in your view, is this the case that there is no separation?
Absolutely there is no
separation. Here, do you feel any separation? Is there any separation, you, me?
I say, wait, physically there is. You have got a black suit, you're a fairer person than me.
But
and
you
so
don't feel...
If I felt dualistic, I wouldn't even sit down to discuss with you. Because then we'll be intellectually, we play with each other.
Right. Now, perhaps we're saying the same thing, but it always comes out in my mind as a both and. We are both separate and we're united.
So, when you love somebody with your heart, not with your mind, do you feel separate?
I do in some... It's both. I feel both separate and together.
Then it's not love.
I wonder, because love... Part of the joy of love is the relationship, which involves, in some sense... Like Ramakrishna said, I don't want to be sugar.
I don't know Ramakrishna. I don't want to know any authority. I don't want to quote any bird.
Don't get hung up on.
No, we are dealing with facts, not what somebody said. The fact is
that in love, there is the part of the beauty and glory of it is the sense of unity, embracing what in certain respects is. Separate.
Sir, just a minute, sir. Let's be a little more unromantic about it. The fact is, when there is love between man and woman, in that is involved possession, domination, authority, jealousy, all that's involved in it.
There's some of that.
Of course there is. And comfort, sexual pleasure, and the remembrance of all. So, is all that. It's a bundle of all that.
And there's some positive things left out.
And do I... Is love jealousy? Is love pleasure? Is love desire? If it is pleasure, it's merely the activity of thought. Say, well, I slept with that woman. Therefore, she is mine. And the remembrance of all that, that's not love. Thought is not love. Thought breeds fear. Thought breeds pain. Thought breeds pleasure. And pleasure is not love.
Thought breeds only negative.
What is the positive? Which is, what is the positive thing that thought produces, except mechanical things?
A love poem.
Sir, love poem, what? The man feels something and puts it down.
Yes.
The putting down is irrelevant, merely a form of communication. But to feel it is nothing to do with thought. To translate it then is necessary for thought.
The thought and words can also give form to our feelings, which would remain inchoate without them. Bring them to resolution, to satisfying resolution through their expression.
Is relationship a matter of thought?
Not only, but thought can contribute to a relationship.
Thought is always the old. Relationship is something new.
Yes, but there are new thoughts.
Ah, There is no such thing as neutral. Forgive me to be so emphatic.
No, I like that.
I don't think there is a new thought. There is no thought in free. Thought can never be free because thought is the response of memory. Thought is the response of the past.
When a great poet comes through with the right words to articulate a new perception
that
nobody has before, not even God, has thought of those particular words.
But that's only a matter of a cunning gift of putting words together. But what we are talking about...
noble trait.
And that's a minor
poetry
thing.
Poetry is a great concept.
No, sir, that's a minor thing. The major thing is to see the beauty of life. And to see the immensity of it, and to love.
There it ended, a conversation with Krishnamurti. But what ended was only the words, not the substance, for Krishnamurti was speaking, as always, of that life that has no end and no beginning.